For the week of August 29th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 69, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wow, I was waiting for something exciting to happen there. Like, and at the Emmys?
I couldn't think of anything clever.
I know, I think this is the first time that Michael has actually said exactly where he is, as opposed to making something up, like out behind.
Completely stumped us.
I don't ever make anything up. The problem was that the only ticket I could get was to the Conan O'Brien celebration party for his win on The Tonight Show, and that didn't work out, so.
So you were there alone?
I was there alone.
Well, what we're referring to, of course, is the Emmy Awards, which happened last night. We're going to be talking a lot about television on this episode. Rick Porter from Zap2It will stop by, and he's going to fill us in on all the big winners and surprises. We hope to get David Wilde on the line. Now, of course, he's been on the program before. Besides being a contributing editor to Rolling Stone, he was one of the writers on last night's Emmy telecast. Then, Alex Ben Block, a senior editor for The Hollywood Reporter, will join us to fill us in on how we might be watching television in the future. That is, if Google and Apple have their way. Of course, we'll review the week's top entertainment news during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
I could have been getting an exorcism, I suppose, if I was going to talk about where I was, because the number one movie at the box office, in a bit of a surprise as far as how big it was The Last Exorcism. People love exorcisms. This movie grossed $21.3 million, way above most predictions that I saw coming into the weekend. And number two, also stronger than expected, was Takers from Screen Gems, which grossed $21 million. It almost took the top spot. And number three was the Sylvester Stallone flick, The Expendables, which grossed another $9.5 million. Worldwide is at $157 million. It's just about ready to become his biggest hit since Cliffhanger. At number four was Eat, Pray, Love, the Julie Roberts film, which grossed $7 million. That's made $60 million so far. Number five is The Others Guys with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg, another $6.6 million. It's just about to hit $100 million in the U.S. Maybe it'll be the first Will Ferrell movie to be a really big hit overseas. And at number six is the vampire spoof Vampires Suck, which grossed $5.3 million. It's at $27 million total, and it only cost $20 million to make.
But it dropped off 56%.
As one would expect, because it's a piece of junk. And at number seven is Inception, which grossed another $5.1 million. That's at $270 million in the U.S., $650 million worldwide and counting. At number eight, Nanny McPhee Returns, another $4.7 million. That's a bit of a disappointment in the U.S., $17 million total. And number nine is The Switch, the Jennifer Aniston film, which is struggling to get to $20 million total. And at number 10 is Piranha 3D, which dropped almost 60%, like a lot of horror films, and grossing $4.3 million or $18 million total, even though the Weinstein said, we're going to make a sequel, even though the opening was weaker than one expected. And another little bit of box office news, Toy Story 3 officially passed $1 billion worldwide, only the seventh movie in history to do that, joining Avatar, Titanic, the third movie in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, The Dark Knight, and Alice in Wonderland. And Avatar, of course, was re-released in theaters and nobody cared because it had already grossed $1.8 billion. And, of course, it already is out on DVD, so nobody went to see it, really. And finally, I in looking at all the notes about the movies this weekend, I got caught up in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which I thought it only made a few million dollars in the U.S. It made $12.5 million, which is a lot for a foreign language film, and it grossed $90 million in the rest of the world.
Have you seen that movie?
No, I haven't, because I haven't even read the books. I'm almost embarrassed to read the books, because everybody has a copy. So,
I've seen Dragon Tattoo, and over the weekend, I saw Playing with Fire.
Awesome. With Fire. Tell us.
You know, I'm a big fan of the books, so of course I'm going to think that the movies aren't as good. I thought that the adaptation of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was pretty good. Adaptation of The Girl Who Plays with Fire, I thought was really lazy.
But is it a good movie? I mean, in other words, it might be a lazy adaptation, but a great movie.
It's really hard to judge because, to my way of thinking, they leave out some really important aspects of the book. So it's hard to judge. I mean, it would be better if you asked somebody who had never read the books whether they thought it was a good movie, because I was disappointed.
But $100 million worldwide for that movie. That's apparently, I think the Daniel Craig remake is going to have more competition in the hearts and minds of moviegoers than you might have expected at first.
Possibly so, yes.
That's a lot of money for a foreign language film. So, and what do you think of The Girl?
Who plays Lisbeth Salander? Noomi Noomi Rapace or whatever her name is. I'm not a fan, but I know that I am in the minority with that one. I think she is too hard to play Lisbeth, whereas Lisbeth is supposed to kind of look like a China doll, which explains why she has tattoos and piercings and such to kind of belie that. But I'm not a fan.
Well, interestingly, I mentioned that Piranha 3D, the Weinsteins, in trying to drum up box office, said, we're going to do a sequel. I think just to get people thinking, oh my God, it must be a hit. In contrast, I looked up Step Up 3D. You can bet there will be a Step Up 4D because this movie has grossed $110 million worldwide.
4D? What happens with 4D? We go into space?
Perhaps. But, you know, it's ready to pass the original in box office, and it's probably going to equal the sequel, which grossed $150 million worldwide. And for the amount this movie cost to make, why wouldn't they make up a Step 4?
And before you write in, Michael just said that Avatar made $1.8 billion. We know that it is around $2.7 billion. I'll tell you though, you know what? Speaking of writing in, we got a ton of emails regarding our headline from last week's episode, which was, I think, something to the effect of, you know, who says Jennifer Aniston is a movie star? But when you look at it, The Switch, $4.6 million, it dropped 44.8%. It's only made $16.4 million so far. It's not doing too well.
Just because a movie does bad at a box office doesn't mean the star is not a movie star. But we've said all this before.
Not only that, you're not the only one who's saying it. Of course, many of our listeners wrote the same thing. So thank you for all of your lovely email. We read them all. And if we had enough time today, we would get to them. But we are going to be talking about the Emmys. Should we move on and get Rick Porter?
And thanks for catching my mistake of referring to Titanic's worldwide box office of $1.8 billion, which is so passé these days compared to Avatar.
Well, as expected, the box office news is not as big as it is usually. It's the end of August, and the movies that are being released, many people and many entertainment news pundits feel are being dumped at the end of August. What really is the big news this week, and joining us to discuss it, is staff editor for ZapToIt.com, Rick Porter, the big news being the Emmy Awards, which happened last night. Rick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Now, did you attend the awards last night?
No, I was in the ZapToIt bunker.
And now ZapToIt, of course, covers the television industry.
Right.
And what did you think of the awards?
I thought it was among the more entertaining Emmys that we've had in quite a while, both in terms of the actual broadcast and the people who won. It was more fun to watch than it usually is.
Rick, I liked some of the comments you made online about this show. I had the same reaction. They had a lot of the acting categories for comedy and drama front-loaded in the first half of the show. And then they had some things like miniseries and TV movies in the second half. And like you say, Tom Hanks and Claire Danes, these are, you know, big stars. But it seems strange. I understand they go comedy, drama, reality. They have these sort of pods that they do now to encase the different categories. But what would you suggest they do? Simply move the acting categories up towards the top, or should they mix them up again and not do these sort of isolated pod approach to the awards?
Yeah, the sort of middle third of the show seemed to slow down quite a bit when they were going through the variety and the movie and miniseries categories. And I get why they, you know, would put those sort of towards the end of the show, because theoretically they have, you know, the movies and the miniseries have a little more star power, but they're also not sort of top of mind for viewers as much anymore, because there aren't movies and miniseries on the broadcast networks anymore.
I couldn't even remember seeing any of those movies or miniseries except for The Pacific. Of course, I remember the huge advertising campaign for it. Didn't see it, but I remember it.
Yeah, and Temple Grandin was an excellent movie and deserved all the wins it got. I just, you know, probably I don't have the ratings figures on hand for that, but I can't guess that it was even as much as an episode of Mad Men.
And now Temple Grandin being the movie, I guess, was it on HBO?
That's yes. Right.
And it was starred Claire Danes and one other person who won an award, who's now
David Strathairn and Julia Ormond.
Julia Ormond.
And,
yes. Both, yes. So it won three awards. Four
no, it
awards,
won five.
Actually. Oh, wow.
In addition,
okay.
And as well as best director for a movie.
How could you forget a chick flick with bull's balls, Sperling?
Yes, that is what Julia Ormond called it. And, you know, the way I could forget it is the show was 3 hours long. I was forgetting it as it was happening.
Yeah, it was short.
I will say it moved at a pretty good clip, and I think you pointed that out, Rick.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was really well produced. I loved all the sort of packages, kind of celebrating TV as a whole in the past year rather than just what was nominated. And you know, I thought Jimmy Fallon did a really nice job too. I loved his sort of musical tribute to 24 and Law and Order and Lost.
Well, Rick, one thing that you just said was that you imagined the HBO movie Temple Grandin probably had fewer ratings than even a typical episode of Mad Men. But in fact, Mad Men only reaches 3 million people a week, roughly, at least as far as its initial viewing. Here's my biggest question about the show. I feel like an award show like this should celebrate the shows and get people excited to go see a show. And however entertaining the broadcast was, I would defy anyone who doesn't already watch Mad Men and Breaking Bad and most of the shows that they featured. I'd defy them to explain what the show was about or be excited to see it. We saw very few clips from the actual shows. We got very little sense of what they're about or the performances that were given that won the awards. I mean, I always think they should have bigger and longer clips from the actual shows they're honoring. What do you think about that?
I think in a perfect world, that would be great. I would love to see more of that. It didn't feel like they had to cut as much just for time this year, but the Emmys are also sort of bound by these arcane rules that say, you know, certain groups, whether they're writers or directors or performers, have to be in the show every year. It's part of sort of bylaws of the TV Academy, and those cannot be cut. So they're kind of handcuffed in terms of how much time they can take for any given thing and still have a 3-hour show.
But what they don't need is a lot of new material. You know, instead of trying to come up with new comedy material and a new joke about Modern Family and having an exec come in and say we should do 3D or musical spoofs and musical stuff, show clips from the actual shows. They've spent a year writing and creating shows that you think are so good they deserve to be nominated for an Emmy. It must be entertaining stuff. Show that instead of trying to create new stuff and fill up the airtime. There's at least half an hour you could cut out of that and show actual clips.
Well, I guess what you're trying to suggest is that the Emmys do what the Academy Awards does, which is they introduce each film. Now, of course, they have 10 of them, but they actually show kind of a little trailer for each film that's nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, and I think there could have been a way that they could have handled that a little better. Maybe in the opening montages for each genre, they could have, you know, done sort of a review of the year and then sort of longer spotlight clips for the nominated shows or something like that. That might have been a nice little wrinkle.
Well, and Michael, all of the jokes for Modern Family are going to be new because it is a new show. And in fact, a lot of new shows won this year.
Yeah, a lot of new. Obviously, Modern Family was best comedy, and it won 3 awards last night and 3 more at the Creative Arts 2 weekends ago. So has 6 total. Glee won 2 last night. The Good Wife had Archie Punjabi win last night. It was kind of an upset. Although that was a really, really wide open category. So,
right, that was the upset. Everybody was expecting Juliana Margulies to win for The Good Wife. I'm sure you were, Karen.
But that was a different category.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I was going to Kira Sedgwick, who won for Best Actress Drama when everybody thought Juliana Margulies would win. I'm really not doing too well with this television stuff.
Yeah, you're really not. Rick, what was your favorite part of the night?
Time suck, though it may have been. I thought Jimmy Fallon's musical obit and the Modern Family sketch with George Clooney was pretty funny. But I liked the fact that it celebrated TV. I also thought the opening Born to Run bit was pretty funny too.
And this was the opening that Jimmy Fallon did with cast members from Glee and Lost.
How did they ever get the rights to that song?
You just go to them. You just call them up and get the rights. It's easy.
Yeah, through ASCAP and through the publisher.
I think Bruce Springsteen has said that his kids are Glee fans or something.
So oh, really? Okay, well, that explains that.
For his kids.
That's actually news.
So it's been my suspicion, too, that that he might be one of the people they want to do for their Super Bowl episode this year. And so this might have been like a test case. I have no solid information on that. That's spinning things out of what I saw last night.
Now, I was a little surprised that Conan O'Brien didn't win, but I guess in retrospect, his show is canceled. So,
well, that's never stopped a show from winning before.
That's true.
That was a bit of a disappointment because it would have been very interesting to see Conan accept an Emmy on NBC's dime, basically.
Yeah, that's right. Because the show did air on NBC, and The Tonight Show, of course, is on NBC. And this is the first time that a network has aired the show live on both the East Coast and West Coast. It's the first time since 1976, so, and I really appreciated it because usually on the West Coast, we have to wait 3 hours for the show to start, and then we know all the winners because it's on the front page of the New York Times and it's all over Twitter. This year, they broadcast it twice, once at 5 o'clock for the live telecast, and then they repeated it at 8. So that was kind of nice.
Yeah, I think that was just an acknowledgement of the fact that everybody's going to know by the time the show airs on the West Coast if it's tape delayed. And
yeah, and everyone on Twitter knows.
Yeah, and it makes the show less prone to DVRing, which means more people are watching it live, which means more people are watching the ads.
What's your most disappointing streak? Is it Jon Stewart winning for 8 seasons in a row, Bryan Cranston winning Best Actor in a Drama for 3 seasons in a row, Mad Men winning Best Drama 3 seasons in a row, even though its 3rd season was widely acknowledged as its weakest by far? What's your most disappointing ongoing streak that the Emmys have?
I think probably Jon Stewart's win, which is not a knock against The Daily Show. I was just kind of hoping, just for the sake of good television, that Conan might win. I actually loved last season of Mad Men, so I thought it was a deserving winner.
We talked a little bit about the unpredictability of this year's Emmys in certain categories, and of course, you just mentioned The Daily Show winning for, I think, the 8th time, so there were some predictable categories. What do you think the show signifies overall for television?
On the comedy side, it means that there's more than 2 or 3 good comedies on television right now, and the fact that Glee and Modern Family had a combined 30-some nominations this year and both won several awards. I think it shows well that that comedy isn't dead, as everybody was saying it was for the last few years.
Well, now, Karen, are you happy that Jim Parsons won Best Actor in a Comedy Series for The Big Bang Theory?
I am. Yeah, I think it's about time.
Yeah, I know you're a big fan.
You have to wonder, how does Jonathan Galecki feel about all this? Isn't he slightly pissed off?
What can you do? You want to give him a call and we can ask?
Yeah, let's call him.
Right, I'll get him on the phone right away.
No, I was happiest to see Jim Parsons win. I was happy to see the guy from Breaking Bad win. What's his name?
Aaron Paul.
Yeah. I was disappointed that Lost didn't win and disappointed that Conan O'Brien didn't. Those were my big things for the night.
But wasn't Lost kind of a disappointment in the end?
It doesn't matter. You reward the entire show.
And the way the Emmys work, too, you reward the sampling of episodes that they send, or for the actors, the one specific episode that they submit.
Rick, don't you think that should always be sort of a helpful way to sample all the shows? I mean, I always feel like, yes, okay, they submit a particular episode, but basically I'm going to look at the whole season because I'm watching all these shows. And it drives me nuts when they say, oh, yeah, but they delivered the wrong episode. And it's like, well, but don't you watch TV? You know, that should be for the people who don't watch a show.
That is my and a lot of people's perpetual ongoing beef with the Emmys, is that I get that when you're trying to, you can't expect however many hundreds or thousands of people are in the TV Academy to watch every episode of every show every year. I think the sense for people who don't pay attention to this stuff all the time is that it's, you know, a body of work award and not just for a specific episode or handful of episodes.
Well, Rick, thank you very much for stopping by and filling us in on all of the winners and what was good and bad about last night's Emmy Awards. If people want to find you, they can go to zaptoit.com. Now, do you have a Twitter account?
Yeah, it's at zaptoitrick.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
Well, it was very nice of Rick Porter, again, of zaptoit.com, to join us and talk about the Emmy Awards and the Emmy telecast. Now, speaking of the telecast, of course, David Wilde has been on the show before, and you will recall he is the contributing editor at Rolling Stone. He is a TV writer. In fact, he helped write the Emmy telecast, and he also is an author. His book, He Is, I Say, is about Neil Diamond. I gave it out last Christmas as a holiday gift.
And Hanukkah really would have been the better holiday.
Well, it went over really well. I'll say that.
Thank you.
David, thank you for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Congratulations on the show.
Oh, thank you.
13.5 million people saw it last night, and which is in line with the ratings from, I guess, previous years.
Yeah, actually, though, I think what people don't get is that this is every 4 years when it rotates to NBC, they run it earlier because of football. And so really hanging sort of even with last year is kind of a great moral victory.
Well, we were just talking about how nice it was for those of us on the West Coast that it was broadcast live at 5 o'clock and then, of course, repeated at 8. But it was very nice that...
I got to tell you, that was so nice for the writers because we get paid again.
Oh!
I was hoping for another broadcast around 11:30 midnight.
Now, there was a huge team of writers. I think I counted like 8 or 9 writers that you were a part of.
Yeah, it was, you know, Jimmy has a staff that he has, and then there's sort of the, there were 3 of sort of the Emmy writers, and it was a big, happy family.
Well, now, how much of Jimmy Fallon's material did you write for him, or did his team write for him?
Well, A, you're never supposed to say who wrote what, but I think Jimmy's team win deserves total credit. They had a big win, but, you know, and Jimmy himself, who I don't think was credited as a writer.
I don't think so.
And I think he is a writer, so I don't know. It's all credit due to them. Let's give it all to them.
Well, I would say let's give credit to the writers because it's important to have professional writers working on a show, as demonstrated by the quoting of the tweets sent in by viewers. I hope that's one experiment that they don't continue next year.
Well, I don't want to say too much, but there was a little tribute to writers. I used it, my 5th grade joke, writers is good.
Yes.
make us look. And Joel McHale, it's so funny because I actually called him before the show, like a day before the show, and said, is this stupid? You know, maybe we should come up with something else. And he goes, it's brilliant. And I said, well, that's great to know because I was brilliant in 5th grade, apparently.
Speaking of brilliance, I thought that rather than just state out the names of who was nominated for best comedy writing or best comedy directing or drama writing, you actually put these little short docu moments together where the nominees answered a question. In one case, it was the, you know, when did you get your first laugh? I thought that was brilliant.
Loved
absolutely
it.
You know, and that was Don Mischer, who's the executive producer, and his team of producers, Charlie Haeckel and Julianne Hare. They're wonderful. And in our initial discussions, we did the last 2 years with them, including last year with Neil Patrick Harris. The effort is to basically, how do you get people to care about people they don't know about? It's easy to get them to care about a star that they or a show that they might like, but the sort of people who they don't know. So that's the attempt, to sort of make you get a little window into who these people are.
And as a plus, you forced all the creative teams behind those shows to come up with clever ways for them to answer those questions and come up with little comedy bits.
Yeah. No, in fact, that's been going on for years with the sort of...
the writing.
But it's, I think Don and his team did a great job getting those together.
Now, I really love John Hodgman's backstage commentary, but there were times that, at least in the 5.1 mix, I was watching it on HD, that I could barely understand what he was saying. I couldn't hear it at all in certain times. And he would kind of make a little announcement as the person who won walked up on stage. He would explain a little bit about who they were, and they were usually very humorous. But it was...
Oh, yeah, you know, we work on those. That's one of the things we do, and John is so great to work with, so much fun. I don't know about the audio issues because I was, you know, back there. And I was particularly proud of one about Sabrina in which I tried to get John to say that he felt he was born to play the part of Audrey Hepburn that Julia Ormond got. I felt that was particularly fun moment for me.
I liked that too, though they should never have remade that movie in the first place. But I wondered about with the backstage, whether there was more sort of tension and hysteria because they had a lot more cameras feeding online feeds, whether that created a level of complexity this year. Because you could go online and watch backstage and watch the thank you cam and watch all this sort of stuff going on behind the scenes.
I feel the level of complexity was that I twice had relatives tweeting me going, I just saw you on TV. And I think that might, ultimately, the research of NBC might show that my face and hairline might have scared America. Ultimately.
Well, now there were a couple of odd moments. One came, I guess Matthew Weiner was talking. He won the writing award for Mad Men, and they just cut him off. He then came back later when Mad Men won for the 3rd straight year the Best Drama Series Award, and kind of made a little bit of a joke out of it and said, "I guess you know where did I leave off?"
Yeah. Well, let me explain that people don't. Get that certain problems in TV are just, we don't really, Don Mischer, who's the executive producer, is not a rude guy. He's incredibly elegant, you know, very polite man. The problem is that the Emmys have you know, I do a lot of these shows. It has about three times more awards than, say, the Grammys or most any other, more than double most shows. And so you're facing such a huge time problem to get the show off in time. And the fact that, as you were saying earlier, we were going live and then repeating at 8, that's why there was such pressure to keep it moving, because otherwise at 8 o'clock we'd be sort of in the last 5-10 minutes of a show as it's supposed to be beginning, and it would sort of confuse the viewer. When you're doing it, that was part of the reason we were, you know, I don't think anyone likes playing people off, but it was just a matter of there's only one speaker allowed, and I think in some cases when the second speaker would step forward, that would be a reason, and also just when we had incredible time pressures.
The LA Times pointed to Matthew Weiner's comments out and thought it was obnoxious and that he was sort of crowing about being up there for the third year in a row. But in fact, he was just making light of the fact that he went over time earlier and got cut off, as will happen. The one thing
he got cut off right as he was saying something about his insecurity, I thought was...
But I did like that you guys showed the show clock and how many minutes over the time you were. I saw that during one of the commercial breaks and thought that was hilarious. Now the viewers are saying, oh, I hope they'll get the show done in time. We're 1:56 over right now.
Right. No, that was Don Mischer's idea, and it was to make the show more transparent. And I think it's fun, especially, you know, as long as I'm not on camera, it seems like a good idea.
I did notice, though, that they let Al Pacino talk forever and ever, or maybe it was just... felt
he's
that way
star.
Because I couldn't get my eyes off his hair.
You know what's funny is that's one of those moments I was running to tell someone something. I'd missed his speech, and I did ask someone, how was it? He said, long. That's all. I missed it entirely.
It was long. It was rambling. He looked like death warmed over. It was really...
He's Al Pacino. He's a lot.
Well, another long moment came with Ricky Gervais. Did anybody write something for him? Because he was very funny, and it seemed like he was doing it off the cuff.
That was not off the cuff. That was not off the cuff. And he just has the ability. I'll tell you what was off the cuff. I believe the whole Bucky Gunts run, that was off the cuff. But the rest of it was... In fact, it's funny. People will often say, like, it's off the cuff. It's like, then where would the beer and bartenders come from?
Yeah, he offered beer to everyone in the audience because I guess during the Hollywood Golden Globes, he came out hosting the Golden Globes with a beer, and everybody made a big deal out of that. So it was kind of an inside joke, and I wondered how many people actually remembered that in the audience.
It seemed to work. I'll tell you, the funniest moment for me was seeing Matthew Perry, who clearly has had his issues. He was refusing a beer on camera. I saw that. And I wish he also was, I will say, Matthew, who I know and like, he and Lauren Graham sort of added in their own joke that they sort of didn't tell us, and then it fell a little flat and they backed off of it. So it was sort of... Yes. That was not written by any of us. So it was,
oh, really?
That was just a uninvited improv, and I think he probably didn't like it afterwards.
Well, I did like the opener a lot. What I liked especially about that opener where they sort of spoofed Glee and have them all singing Born to Run was it created that sort of fantasy world where television is one big happy family and talk show hosts and, you know, all these people from different shows are working together to do a show. How did you get did you guys have to call up Springsteen to get the rights to parody the song or to perform it?
I talked to Jimmy about that, and he did make a personal call. I even heard a rumor that Glee had wanted to use it and had been denied, and then Jimmy made the call himself. I mean, Glee had been wanted to use it before, and so Jimmy has, you know, had the juice to get it done for the Emmys. And I got to tell you, what you're saying about one big happy family, especially with a host that's as likable as Jimmy and as a person, just a very amiable guy, it sort of did feel like that. There was that camaraderie. You know, John Hamm couldn't have been more game. You know, Tina Fey, everyone was sort of hanging out. It was, you know, and all the comedians, I think, sort of were very loose. And we again, because of the time issues, you might have noticed, we kept the copy very tight. So often it was one joke or a joke about not having, being able to say much, you know, so it was under somewhat difficult circumstances, it was a very amiable vibe at the show. And I think that comes across ultimately.
I kind of like the fact that Stephen Colbert brought up the Human Centipede in his little bit,
yeah,
which is a movie that was the trailer for which was cut by Stephen Garrett, a friend of mine and of Michael Giltz's here. I mean, it was kind of a throwaway movie, and yet it's been brought up now on countless popular culture shows.
Yeah, he has impact on his shows. I actually was talking to him last night, and at the Grammys, I worked with him, and he sort of debuted the iPad there, and I explained that his conspiracy had worked, and my wife had gotten an iPad recently. So I think Colbert has a way of. I even loved Colbert sort of paying his tribute to Tom Hanks and Bosom Buddies. I thought that was very sweet.
In fact, it seemed like some of the winners had writers, because Steve Levitan and Jane Lynch were hilarious.
Well, they are writers. And by the way, Jane Lynch, I just worked with recently as a host. She is a dream. Just the nicest person I've ever. One of the, you know, in a business where there are few, she is unbelievably great to work with and like the easiest person to write for ever.
Well, certainly, if anyone follows your Twitter stream, and they should, you can follow it at Wild About Music. So go to Twitter, and it's Wild About Music, no E at the end of Wild. They would have known that you worked with Jane Lynch and that you were writing at least portions of the Emmy telecast last night. And thank you for joining us and telling us all about it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Is there anything else coming up that we should be plugging or talking about?
I have a new book coming, but I can't talk about it until it's announced. But I'd be glad to do it when it is. And then I guess I did do a blog on Huffington Post this morning early, because backstage George Clooney came and told me he loved my playlist on Huffington Post, where I do regularly. And I was so stunned that I did one just for him, a special by request playlist.
Very cool.
And in fact, if you go on Twitter, you have a song of the day that you put out at least once a day.
Yes, and I haven't done one today, so I better pull it together.
And let's not forget, for Rosh Hashanah, he is, I said, makes a wonderful gift.
That's true.
For Rosh Hashanah. Exactly. Thank you so much for that.
Well, David, thank you for joining us.
Oh, no, thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks for watching, and thanks for not hating it.
Oh, no, got great reviews, and they were well-deserved.
Great. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it was very nice of David to join us, and I don't want to waste any time because we actually have quite the treat for you. Joining us now is Alex Ben Block, a senior editor at The Hollywood Reporter, and he also wrote a book. I'm sure many people have heard of it because it was pretty much a critical acclaim last year, and it continues to sell well from what I understand. George Lucas's Blockbusting, and he's joining us to tell us not about the Emmy telecast, which occurred last night, but possibly who might be winning Emmys in the future and how we will be watching those shows. Alex, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Now, there seems to be a lot of hubbub lately about what Google is doing in the TV space. Do you want to explain a little bit about what their plans are?
Sure. You know, we've heard a lot about that word convergence, when we will all be able to go into the living room and on a single TV using a single remote, we'll have access to broadcast and cable, which of course we already do, but also the internet and databases of all kinds of information, and really a library of every movie or TV show ever made. And to do it all with a single click or a couple of clicks, and to have access to all of this material, and that's kind of the goal of Google TV. And not only to do access, but to do it so that it's on demand, meaning you'll be able to get it when you want, how you want. And you'll be able to use the Google search engine to find the programming you want or a version of the search engine. And then they, in turn, will be able to track what your interests are, what shows you watch, what ads you watch. And so to do that, of course, the technology is already out there, but they're trying to do it in an easier, more sophisticated way, because other people have been trying to do this as well. There's Apple TV, and there's a Microsoft version and other things. But Google is trying to be the first one to really make it a mass consumer product. The hang-up here is getting their fingers and hands and your viewership on the content. In other words, the people who own American Idol or who own sports rights to major leagues that currently air on the big networks are saying, well, what's in it for us? Google is going to sell the ads. Google is going to get the customers. And we think that you're going to do to us what happened to the music business, which got cannibalized, their entire business model was destroyed. While people are listening to a lot of music, they're not making a lot of money. And it's not just about making money, it's about how you pay for programming. TV and movies are very expensive to make. So there has to be a model that works for everybody. And so far, Google has not convince the networks or the studios that they have a model that works for everybody.
It sounds great, and I can see why Hollywood would be trepidatious, but it's different than, say, using Google to find Hulu and then watching that show embedded on the Hulu site, or using Google to find ABC.com and watch a show that's available there with their ads embedded. This is going to be a whole runaround of that system and have it be a separate entry to an episode of Lost or whatever it may be?
Absolutely, and in fact, it threatens the existence of Hulu, and it threatens the use of, say, ABC TV or the CBS website, because they control those. And when you go to those sites like ABC.com or even Hulu, the technology includes advertisements that were sold by the network. And often you can't even fast forward or eliminate those. You've got to watch those if you're going to watch the show. And so the ads are being sold by CBS or ABC, and then they are agreeing to do it, and it's on their timetable. They own a piece of Hulu, several of them, and they can do it when they want, and they can pull it off when they want. And some shows, American Idol, of course, being the most biggest example, are not even available on any of those. You can't get them. You can only get promos or teasers or after the fact. And so if you take away from the networks, which are advertiser-driven, their ability to sell advertising to support their content, then they have to get paid some other way. Google is going to have to write them a big check. And Google is not really offering that. They're saying, well, there's other advantages. It's promotional. We'll share some advertising. We'll do this or that. You know, with this addressable advertising, there's new possible ways we can work together. And CBS or ABC or NBC are saying, well, what do we need you for exactly? We want to sell our own ads. We want our own business model. We pay the creators. We have to pay the residuals. It's very expensive. I mean, I just wrote about the show The Pacific on HBO. That's a $200 million miniseries. That's serious money for even for a 10-hour show. So now HBO, as part of Time Warner, is working on what they call Television Anywhere. They have their own name for it. I think it's HBO To Go. But they control it, and you have to be a subscriber to HBO to get it. And so it makes sense for them. They understand the business model. The problem with Google TV so far is the people who create the content don't understand how they're going to get their money and then share it with the creative community. And until they can answer that question and assure them that they aren't going to do to them what happened to the music business, which has literally been destroyed by new technology, and the winners here are not the old companies that traditionally did this, they're the new companies that are handling the distribution. And so these traditional media companies are saying, you better come up with a new plan or else we're not going to play the game.
Well, now what you just said is very important. Google is saying, hey, look, we're going to make TV better. But Harold Vogel, in an LA Times article called Google TV Plan is Causing Jitters in Hollywood, Harold Vogel, the president of a media investment firm, Vogel Capital Management, he said, and I quote, it's kind of an end run around their control of signal, and that's scary. And the there in that sentence is referring to the networks. And he goes on to say, because if you don't control the signal, then you can't provide your own advertising. It really destroys the legacy business model. And while there is a legacy business model, Google, on the other hand, is saying, we have no idea how we're going to make money.
Well, that doesn't really work for the people who are already spending money and making money. And Hal Vogel, who's a friend of mine for many years and the author of one of the great entertainment economic books that is important to all of us in the business, is absolutely correct. It is an end run. So if you are the opposing football team and the other guy's making an end run around you, you don't cheer him for what a great runner he is. You say, hey, you're destroying our team. We're going to lose, and we're not going to put up with that. And when you're talking about CBS and NBC and ABC and Fox and these big studios, they're very powerful entities, and they're already pretty nervous about the way things are going, because instead of being the closed garden of the past when they controlled everything, now with these new platforms, people can make end runs around them. YouTube, which Google owns, is an end run around them. So it's not to their advantage to hand over their gems, their TV shows. You know, Modern Family just won the Emmy. Should Modern Family now be available on Google TV on demand anytime you want? And what is that going to mean to ABC, which is broadcasted? It means people aren't going to tune in pattern when they're supposed to and watch the commercials the way they did before. So if you can't replace that income, why would they do business?
Well, it's also an end run around the cable and satellite providers as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're platforms. So if you're DirecTV or others, what this is really about is the whole system is currently set up so there's a content creator, then there's a wholesaler, which could be the cable system, could be the satellite provider, could be somebody else, and then there's the customer at retail. And so right now, we have to go through the wholesaler to get to the retail. They're saying, let's eliminate the wholesaler. You create the content, we'll provide the platform at retail that goes right to the customer, and we don't need the wholesaler anymore. Well, that's not going to please the wholesaler. Comcast is about to buy NBC. They are the wholesaler. And so you can't expect them to lay down and let Google run over them. And they've seen what's happened to other industries where new technology and new media have come in and done that, and they don't want it to happen to them.
It sounds like Google has a huge challenge ahead of it to convince these people to come on board. And even that simpler step of Apple TV or set-top boxes that let you access anything that's online like YouTube or Hulu videos and watch them on your TV screen, even that has failed because just on a technical level, it's so complicated. It sounds like Google has a tough road to hoe before it can even get any content. Has anybody agreed to work with them?
Well, Sony is their business partner along with Intel and some others. And so my understanding is that Sony, which controls its own library of content, even though they don't own a network in the United States, there's stuff they can put on. We're not talking about whether they can put stuff on. You can start Google TV tomorrow and they can fill up channels 24/7, no problem. What they can't give you is American Idol, NFL football, and Modern Family. That's what drives traffic. That's what people want to see. So if you want to see the old stuff, not a problem. But if you want to see the new stuff and you want to see it when you want, how you want, and you want Google to sell the ads, that's a huge problem, and nobody has solved that problem yet.
Well, it's an interesting problem, and I wonder if, as usual, businesses will strive to hold on to a legacy business model, even if that means that a newer, possibly more lucrative business model that comes along goes by the wayside. I wonder if that's the case here. And of course, if I had the answer to that, if any of us had the answer to that, we'd be quite wealthy and running networks or technology companies like Google or even Apple, which is rumored to be releasing Apple TV either later this year or early next year.
And having the same problem, getting the cooperation of the content owners. You know, in music, they lowered the price of the music and they made it more available. And, you know, from what I could tell, the record companies and who previously flourished are all barely alive. So it hasn't really worked out well for them, but it sure has driven Apple stock into the stratosphere.
That's right. It's this whole argument of trading analog dollars for digital dimes. And that's exactly
right,
what happened.
And trading it from the old guy to the new guy.
Right.
The old guy's not too happy about it.
Right. Well, certainly we'd like to thank you for joining us. Again, the book, George Lucas's Blockbusting, can be purchased on Amazon. We're going to be placing a link to that in the show notes. Alex Ben Block, senior editor for The Hollywood Reporter, and you're also on Twitter. AB Block is the username to look up.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and good luck to you. And I'm not sure I want to wish Google good luck, but it's an interesting topic.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Yeah, one further wrinkle we didn't get to him, and it was great to talk to him. He was very lucid about the whole issue, is that Apple, through its iTunes, is trying to sell reruns. They're looking to rent episodes of TV shows for 99 cents rather than just selling them as they do now for $2 or $3. So if you maybe just missed an episode, you don't need to buy a whole season, you just want to miss one show of, you know, Mad Men, you could rent it for 99 cents and you'd have a chance to watch, and then it would disappear off your server after a certain time.
Such a good idea.
I think it's a good idea. There's so many different areas of wanting to make stuff available to people the way they want to watch it and let them consume it. The only thing I can't figure about Google TV is what advantage it offers to anyone other than Google.
Well, that's the problem.
Well,
It doesn't seem like they made a very good argument. But, you know, I wouldn't be that scared because Google's entry into newspaper advertising was a flop. Apple TV has flopped repeatedly. Trying to just get a set-top box to pull your Hulu onto your TV is difficult. Trying to retrain the whole industry and create a whole new model, that seems a huge leap.
Well, and they've also had a couple of big losses. I mean, Google Wave, not a good one. Google Buzz, I mean, they haven't been doing so great in their own backyard.
Yeah, but you know what? At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter for Google. I mean,
did you
Google,
really just say at the end of the day?
Yes, I said that. I will be whipping out some other cliches before the end of this episode. I can guarantee you. Google Wave, how much did it really cost them? Even if it cost them $1 million to develop and market that, what does it really matter to them?
Saying that in terms of, you know, money. I'm thinking more in terms of like psychologically, what the hell's going on over there? I mean, they've had some real losses.
Well, they've had successes, Gmail and, you know, other things.
Yeah, but
and
that's old.
Well, they do. It doesn't matter. They keep, that's not old to Hotmail.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, at the end of, woo. Let's just say it's a big deal for Google because millions of people still keep using Gmail.
Oh, snap. Well done.
And you know what? You know, Apple TV was a failure. I think they were experimenting. There's this big rumor that they're going to have this $99 set-top box that you will be able to use your iPhone or iPad to control, and that's what the little mouse pad thing is that they launched recently. Who knows? It'll be interesting to watch, that's for sure. But for the sake of time, we should move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. In fact, our very first story is about pay television. Last week, we talked at length about cable versus satellite versus going online, the way Google and Apple want us to do. We should have emphasized this historic event. In the second quarter, pay TV lost subscribers for the very first time in history. That is, more people canceled their subscriptions than new people signed up. Analysts blame the recession, not cord cutting. But Karen, do you subscribe to pay TV? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
No, I don't subscribe to, well, I mean, I get cable.
That's what we mean, yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is a big question mark, I think, at this point. I haven't quite decided.
I'm not quite sure that was one of the choices, but Michael.
It's a big deal. It's the biggest recession in 70 years, so it's a reasonable why it might have happened. But anytime something happens for the first time in history, it's notable.
Well, the battle between American Idol and Simon Cowell's The X Factor is on, baby! In the UK, it was revealed that the live singing competition The X Factor sometimes uses auto-tune to adjust the voices of singers. They insist it's just to compensate for different microphones. Though we say, why not give all the singers the same type of microphone? Idol producers say they never have and never will use auto-tune on live shows. Though, of course, they do have contestants lip-sync to pre-recorded tracks at times. Has The X Factor lost credibility? Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because it's so far in advance of when the show is going to debut in the fall of 2011. So it'll be forgotten by then. But it does hurt their credibility a little bit.
Karen?
I think this is a huge deal. I mean, no way. Really?
Okay.
You're right. But in practical terms, I think it's too far away.
Disney is taking its ball and heading home after months, if not years, of wrangling. Disney has decided it no longer wants to be a member of the International Animated Film Society and its annual award show, The Annies. Disney complained that anyone, even people unrelated to animation, could buy a membership. Plus, it's been annoyed that DreamWorks stacks the deck by giving all its employees free membership. Last year, DreamWorks' Kung Fu Panda beat out WALL-E for a top prize, though Pixar has won that prize 6 of the last 10 years. Why didn't Disney just give all its employees free membership? And then we could have good old-fashioned block voting, the way the Oscars used to be. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, at first I thought I was going to say that this was a big deal, but then I'm like, the Annies? The What's-Its? Big whoop.
Michael?
I agree. The Hoosies. I've never heard of the Annies.
No, I've heard of them. I studied animation at NYU, and they've been around for quite a while, and it's the big animation award. And
is it the Golden Globes of animation awards, you know, the old days where it doesn't have a lot of credibility?
Well, I guess what Disney is saying is that is exactly what it is.
All right.
It's the summer doldrums, but people are still headed to Broadway. After posting a closing notice, the Frank Sinatra dance show, Come Fly Away, bumped up 10%. Both the long-running South Pacific and the short-running play, Race, have closed. And Nathan Lane and Bebe Neuwirth and the Addams Family, despite withering reviews, are still pulling in the gold standard of more than $1 million a week. Now that's star power. Michael, is Broadway's continued health a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal because we've seen more Broadway shows turn into movies and movies back into Broadway shows and onto TV. So it's good that Broadway is holding steady with its grosses of last year.
Karen?
Yeah, I agree.
And the Oscar goes to Francis Ford Coppola. Actor Eli Wallach film preservationist Kevin Brownlow, and grumpy French auteur Jean-Luc Godard. Are we psychic? No! These are the honorary Oscars that will be handed out at a special ceremony in December. As of today, however, they haven't even been able to track down Godard, who famously despises Hollywood. Karen, are these Lifetime Achievement winners a big deal or a big whoop?
I always find Lifetime Achievement things to be a big whoop, but why would they give one to somebody who doesn't even want it?
They do that all the time. Michael?
I think it's a big deal because these are all good winners. Godard is a landmark director, not my favorite at all. I much prefer Truffaut. And I've just been reading a new Frank Sinatra biography where he beat out Eli Wallach for his Oscar-winning role in From Here to Eternity because Eli Wallach was too big and brawny.
And now he's not big or brawny. He's, I guess, in his 80s, yeah?
That's right.
And he's in that movie we saw in Cannes, Wall Street 2.
Yes.
Maybe Katie Couric should have lobbied for Larry King's old job after all. In a recent week, Couric's CBS Evening News tied a 20-year low in viewers, a basement-dwelling achievement she also hit in June, with an average of 4.89 million viewers. Brian Williams of NBC hit 7.42 million viewers, and Diane Sawyer hit 6.51 million viewers. The week that hit this historic low featured Couric in Afghanistan. Are people tired of the war, or just tired of Couric? And Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
People just don't want Couric in Afghanistan. Sad but true. This should be a big whoop, but unfortunately, it's becoming a real big deal.
Michael.
I think it's a big deal, but it's just an historic decreasing of people watching Evening News. But it's nice that two out of three anchors are women.
Does Billboard's Hot 100 have some new competition? The Ultimate Chart is a website devoted to detailing the biggest hits in the world, based on airplay, YouTube plays, sales, Facebook, MySpace, friends of the artists, and more. Clicking on a song to listen to it should matter just as much as radio play or sales, they argue. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Obviously, I think this is a big deal. I love this.
Michael.
I think it's a big deal, too, though the first list is very, very similar to the Hot 100, but hopefully they'll get better at, you know, spotting new trends and things that haven't bubbled up.
Karen, those Justin Bieber shirts you bought at his last concert that seemed so expensive, next year they might seem like a bargain. Why? Because American Apparel is leaking money and could declare bankruptcy. It turns out they provide low-cost, high-quality plain t-shirts to screen printers everywhere, with one promoter saying they get 90% of their t-shirts from American Apparel. This could be a huge disrupting influence and drive up prices in the indie music market. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Hang on, I'm selling my Justin Bieber t-shirts right now. This is a big deal.
Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It's a blip. Somebody else will step in to take up the business.
I would totally agree with that. Michael, those four positive reviews for your epic poem, Industrial Wasteland, that you posted under various names at Amazon, they're now illegal. In the first case involving the new FTC rules about truth and advertising on the internet, a company that paid interns to write anonymous glowing reviews of its games and apps settled out of court, admitting its wrongdoing. So all those quote-unquote fake reviews on iTunes and Amazon and elsewhere might be a thing of the past. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I'm sorry. I've got to go on iTunes and delete all my reviews of Showbiz Sandbox and take out this. But that shouldn't stop all the... That shouldn't stop other people from going online and reviewing the show if you enjoy our podcast.
That was you, right? That said I was supposed to be replaced? That was really you, right?
She still remembers.
No, never, never, never.
Yeah, that's difficult. That's a hard one to forget.
Yeah, I think we have like six reviews on
come on, iTunes. We've got a lot more listeners than that. So please click on iTunes, even if you just click on the star rating. We'd really appreciate it.
Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
Oh, we're actually answering this? I think this is a huge deal. I absolutely love this. As somebody who works in social media, I love seeing people who do that kind of stuff get in trouble.
And the nice thing is some people suggested that if the rules are in place, people in social media won't be pressured by companies to post a bunch of fake reviews because you can just turn to your clients and say, I can't do that. It's against the law. And that's got to help you if they're trying to press you to do something stupid.
Yeah, instead of saying it's bad practice, now we can actually say it's against the law. That is kind of nice.
Finally, get ready to say goodbye to the Roloff family. The stars of the TLC reality series Little People, Big World are calling it quits after six seasons and more than 200 episodes. One season alone contained 48 episodes. The parents, as well as one of their four children, are dwarfs, hence the show's title. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop. Show ends after long successful run.
Karen?
Yeah, big whoop. Roloffs makes me crave chocolate and caramel.
Oh my, and title. The reason I put this in is because I'm a big fan of this show. It's a really good show.
I hear it's a good show, but who gives a shit?
And edit.
Little tiny shit.
Double edit.
Well, that brings us to Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. This week, we have kind of an interesting, almost inevitable story about Blockbuster, a video retailer and rental chain here in the United States, which, according to the Los Angeles Times, will be declaring bankruptcy in mid-September. Karen, I know you're shocked by this.
Totally, absolutely shocked.
And Michael, I'm sure you're actually now camped out at your local Blockbuster, at, you know, just trying to prevent them from closing down.
You know, we've all been watching Blockbuster for years, make missteps and drop the ball. I remember when DVDs came out and became dominant and sell-through was the huge thing. And I kept walking into Blockbuster stores thinking, why aren't they devoting more and more space to selling DVDs? Why isn't this store a destination place to buy DVDs of every type? And they never, you know, they took too long to try and adjust to that. And then they took long to adjust to Netflix and the online stuff. They could have been a name brand online for downloading the streaming movies years ago, and they've just missed the boat every step of the way. So this is not only inevitable, it's deserved.
Well, that's exactly
it's not
what...
Like it's not that they missed the boat. They were like an ocean liner that took forever to turn.
Yeah.
Well, again, it's legacy business models or holding on to those legacy business models and not looking at new opportunities that can kill a company. And that's why I brought it up when we were talking to Alex Ben Block. Now, last week, Dallas-based Blockbuster's chief executive, Jim Keys, came to Los Angeles. He met with all the studios, and he was joined by a whole restructuring consultant team that kind of told the studio heads, hey, we're going to be filing for bankruptcy in the middle of September. Guess why he had to do that?
Why?
Because they need to keep them sending DVDs to them so they can stay in business while they restructure.
That's exactly right. And Blockbuster is hoping that during Chapter 11, how many stores did they say they were going to close, Michael?
500 to 800 stores this year after closing 1,000 stores or more than 1,000 stores last year. That's just unbelievable.
Wait, so they're going to keep stores around. I thought that they were going to go into like the Redbox business.
They're doing that as well. They're doing Redbox. They're trying to do online. They're trying to do mail order. They're trying to catch up to everybody else. But they have 3,500 stores around the country. They're going to be closing, you know, another 500 to 800 of them. So they'll be down to, you know, the prime, the better locations in about 2,500 stores around the country. I mean, there's a store on the Upper West Side that closed down a few years ago. Block. It was a great location. And you thought, wow, if that's shutting down, they're in big trouble because they had no competitors or no other video stores around. You know, Tower Records had closed. And that store, you know, six blocks away from Tower Records had to shut down. Well, you know, that's just the end of the real estate is probably worth more than the business, frankly.
My local Blockbuster turned into a Chase Bank. If that's not a comment on today's society, I don't know what is.
The Virgin Megastore down in Union Square is turning into a Dwayne Reed and a bank. It's so, depressing. I love the idea how, remember Redbox last year or earlier this year, everybody was screaming, how can they rent stuff for a dollar a night? It's so terrible, it's going to destroy the business. And now Blockbuster has released about 6,000 branded kiosks that do the same darn thing.
Yeah.
Yes. Built by NCR. Yeah, well, I think that there's no stopping them now. I mean,
it's a good business and it's a reasonable business. Well, $1 for 24 hours is fine.
Right, especially when most people will probably keep it for 3 days.
And, exactly.
And I think what you're looking at here is that Hollywood likes competition. You have Netflix alone in this DVD by mail or DVD or, you know, video streaming over the internet onto your television, but you have nobody else. You have Redbox with these kiosks in the stores, but you have nobody else. And you used to have Blockbuster with brick and mortar stores and Hollywood Video. Hollywood Video went away. So right now, the studios have nobody to turn to but Blockbuster. So they're going to be quite accommodating because they not only want Blockbuster to stick around in their brick and mortar stores for however long that's going to last, but they want them around for streaming. They want a competitor to Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, Blockbuster has a brand name. If somebody new comes in, smart. It's, you know, you're not going to catch up to Netflix and Redbox, but you can at least provide a counterpoint and maybe make some bucks.
Well, and if you had $24 million, you might be able to buy the company because apparently that's how much it's worth.
Sweet. Let's get on that.
Of course, it also has $1 billion in debt, so that might be a bit of a problem. In 1994, Viacom bought Blockbuster for $8.4 billion. And then last week, the company was delisted off the New York Stock Exchange because its stock price was trading below the threshold, and now it's worth $24 million. But of course, the reason they're filing bankruptcy is it allows them to get out of all of these leases and put away all of this junior debt, and they get out of all of that. A bankruptcy judge can't really turn around and say, no, you have to live out the next 10 years of that lease if you're filing for bankruptcy. So all of those leases on those stores will just go away.
Well, good luck to the employees who work there. I used to go to Blockbuster all the time, but it's always scary when you see a company not adjusting to changing times and not saying, all right, there's a new market here. We need to move in there. They should have realized the thing is Blockbuster and making movies available to people, not worried about the way it's done, whether it's brick and mortar or online or shipping it to them or streaming it. And that's the mistake they made.
Speaking of streaming, you can stream our podcast at showbizsandbox.com, our website. Of course, you can also subscribe to it in the iTunes or Zune Marketplace. I guess iTunes isn't a marketplace, it's the iTunes store. But you can subscribe there and you can rate and review the podcast there, please do. And if you want links to any of the stories we've discussed in today's episode, you can find them in the show notes for episode 69 on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you will find links to all of our social networking accounts, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, as well as ways to contact us. You can email us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found, well, apparently in New York, but also on his website, michaelgiltz.com, where links to all of his writing for The Huffington Post and other outlets appears. He's also on Twitter, at Michael Giltz is the username to look up. Karen is on Twitter, at Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. Her website is karenwoodwardonline.com. I'm on Twitter as well, at Sperling is the username to look up. You can find some of my writing on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.